two Sunday evening series at Spirit Rock for senior students, starting this Sunday, on Buddhist practice and sexuality. And it occurred to me that it might be nice to talk about sexuality in this group also. And I thought maybe I should do it on a Wednesday and invite only interested people so that only people who really wanted to talk about sexuality could come. And so I went back and forth a lot. And so anyway, what I'm thinking of doing is talking about sexuality next Monday in this group here, Monday. But I thought it was important to announce it because there are some issues which are kind of difficult or some people would rather not come to, or I didn't want to just have you all show up and hoist it on you. such a delicate topic. So that's what it's pretty likely that's what I'll do next Monday here, is give a talk or have a discussion about the relationship between the practice we do here and sexuality, or what the relationship might be. And what I want to talk about this week is the subject of diversity, because this weekend I did a diversity training. And diversity is an issue which it can also be painful and difficult, like the subject of sexuality is for many people. And part of this practice that we do is to place ourselves in difficult situations, and be willing to place ourselves in the world of suffering and explore that. And for many people, when they first come to a practice like this, it's just for some people it's a relief. It's a lot of it's about just being able to become calm or relaxed. So it's kind of a refuge from hectic or painful or difficult life, refuge from suffering. But as they settle, as you settle in the practice and get some calm and some spaciousness and some level of a deeper trust in your life, then there's a natural tendency to expand the level of the diameter of the area of comfort or safety or trust up against areas that are painful and involve some kind of suffering. So I think it's appropriate to actually be addressing issues which individually and culturally can be quite painful. And the subject of diversity is a kind of a new word for me. I don't know when it was coined exactly. I started hearing about it a couple of years ago, kind of in an ongoing way. And at first I thought it was just another word for racism, the issue of racism. But what it means is that it's exploring all the tensions and difficulties and beauties that exist in our culture and our society out of all the differences that people have. And there are a lot of differences we have. And that diversity causes a lot of suffering also. And so it's not just racism, but it's also class difference, gender differences, sexual differences, educational differences, health differences, many different things. So I'm on the board of the San Francisco Zen Center, and they had their board retreat. We had our board retreat this weekend, Friday and Saturday. And I've been on the board I have a two-year position. And last year, I didn't go to the board retreat because I was appointed to the board after I was already committed for that weekend. But last year at the board retreat, the board fought. Some of the members of the board, they fought. It was a very painful board meeting, apparently. And the painful subject of discussion was ethics. And not someone's ethics, but just the question of ethics in general. Or trying to come up with an ethic. I think I talked about it here before, an ethical guideline for the community. And Zen historically has had a kind of awkward relationship with ethics and precepts because of a focus on ultimate points of view, and ultimate points of view that somehow negate the role of precepts or ethics. So it was a very painful and difficult meeting. So this year they decided to have a diversity training instead of talking about any business. They thought that was safer. And so this wonderful woman named Yeshe Newman led the the weekend. And it started off by just doing exercises, kind of games and stuff, for everybody to relax around each other and have a good time together. And after we kind of relaxed and laughed and played and did all these things together, then she had us all line up on one side of the room. How many people have done diversity training here? Some people done it. It's becoming a very popular thing now in corporate America and in corporations and businesses and large nonprofit organizations and places like that. I think universities probably do it. Anyway, they had everybody stand on one side of the room. And then you had to cross to the other side of the room if you belong to certain groups or categories. So the first group was just all the women had to go across. So you have all the women on one side of the room and all the men on the other side of the room looking at each other. And suddenly the dynamics have changed. And then she'd ask questions like, what does our society say about the group? The other group is not in your group. And what do they say about your group? And where did you learn that message, about that kind of message, about that kind of group? You sat there looking at them, and you look at your own group and see what they look like, and you look at the other group. And then they had also, and then they had different racial categories, African-American, Asian-American, Latin-American, just a whole range. You would go across the room and stand there. And sometimes there were no people in that category, but then the room would be empty on that side, and we'd reflect on what it meant that no one was there. And then there were people who were disabled and people who had came from were poor growing up. There were people, all the people who didn't have a college education. Only one person went across. And that kind of community of people is very well educated people. The only that one person who went across was the abbot. The Zen master who can't read. That's supposed to be the. And then the meeting, kind of the feeling in the room, kind of changed. It kind of became very sober and not tense, but sober. It was a very homogeneous group, so there wasn't a lot of tension. Like it could happen. You can imagine. I mean, in other polarizations can be quite tense. And then the kind of third part of this weekend was. Then this facilitator teaching us or guiding us in certain techniques or ways of reconciling the tensions and problems and difficulties that can arise out of, in a community, and especially when there's a lot of diversity, misunderstanding of each other. And that was very interesting what she had us do. And I thought very much it was what she had us do was our mindfulness practice out loud. And that's where I see the connection very much with our practice we do. She was just doing it out loud. It was bringing attention, compassion, and clear recognition of actual experience, what your actual experience was, out vocally. And again, what I'm thinking about, the reason I'm giving this talk on diversity is not because so much because it's a great topic for our culture, but the question you should have in the back of your mind is, what possible relationship is there between a mindfulness practice and these kind of cultural issues? Is there a relationship? Is there a relationship between your practice, your own individual practice, and other issues in your life, your sexuality, cultural issues, whatever? And I would argue there is. It's a very important one, and that's why I feel like it's okay to talk about. And what was, you know, quite remarkable, many things were remarkable about the workshop, but one of them was that how much people could meet over the differences. That when the differences became quite clear and really stated quite clearly, there was a much deeper meeting of people and more intimacy than there was if there wasn't that kind of clear recognition of differences. It was too easy in that kind of group to gloss over people's differences, to ignore them, sometimes then you're ignoring people's pain and their suffering or their fears or their resistances or whatever. And one of the questions I had in the second half of the workshop was, what does it mean? What is it to be met by someone else? And what is it to meet someone else? We have this expression in English, to be met by someone. And what is it? What is it like when you really feel like someone's met you fully? Or that you, what does it mean when you go out to meet someone so they feel met? What does that mean to have a meeting, a real meeting of two people? This particular abbot who is uneducated, he loves it when two people meet. And sometimes you meet where you most disagree. And so you go in there and you go ahead to have, you know, you talk with him about the Dharma or whatever, and you talk and talk and talk until finally you get to a place where you no longer agree. Kind of the two, and then he says, "We finally met each other," because you really know what you're about then.
Is this the new abbot?
No. I didn't want to say the name, because we're supposed to keep everything at the meeting confidential. It's one of the ground rules, and now I feel even worse. You haven't done one of these trainings. Not everything, but the names. And there's lots of abbot types up there. They have outgoing abbot and incoming abbot and present abbot and to be abbot and they have abbots like, can't believe it. And it's great because the more the better, the more it's safer it is. If you have one abbot, you get into trouble. You have all kinds of... You see? I want our sangha to be big enough so it'll support two teachers, and then I'd be sitting up here with another person, and she would be kind of, hey, that's enough. Because I can't be completely responsible for myself. And one of the techniques that she taught, which is taught many places, and I've talked about it a little before, is the practice of making I statements. How many of you heard of this practice of making I statements? Some, actually, many fewer than I thought would say. And making I statements is making statements where you refer to how it is in your own experience what's happening, your own direct experience. So rather than saying, oh, you pushed me around. You say, oh, when you start yelling at me, then I feel like I can't be heard. And I feel like my voice can't be heard, and I start succumbing. I feel a lot of fear. And you say what it's actually like for you. Rather than saying, you lousy, no good bastard. You say, when you don't clean up your dishes after you, then I feel like you kind of don't realize that I live in this house also. And I feel kind of disrespected. So there's a huge difference between making an I statement and a you statement. If you make an I statement, the tendency is it's not going to polarize the situation so much. It's not going to be antagonistic. But if you make you statements, it tends to feed the kind of polarization. So, can someone think of a better example of a difference between you and an I? Some of you who know about it? To really drive the point home?
My experience has always been you statements imply blame. Now, when you blame somebody, you put them on the defensive immediately. And when you make an I statement, you're making a statement about yourself and a feeling or a perception. And that's received more easily than. Uh-huh.
And it's also much closer to the truth. I mean, what the truth is kind of awkward, but the truth is really what your direct experience is and not your interpretation of it. And you statements are often interpretations of the situation more often than they are actual factual statements. Like, you no good, lousy, whatever. That's an interpretation for sure. And blame tends to be very much an interpretation. Yes?
Giving a body experience is a good idea. You know, when you said that, I could really feel my belly tighten up.
Uh-huh.
Or my calves, or, you know, going into your body. And it's like there can't be any argument about that.
Yeah. And but then the question is, what does that body contraction mean? And that's, I think that's useful to say. And I feel contracted might be enough, and then the person, you know, suddenly relaxes, and there can be a conversation. Or then there's, if you say that, then there could be some spaciousness for you to kind of check in more carefully. The body can be more obvious, and so you go, oh, I'm contracted, and then everybody quiets, and they, oh, it's because of fear, something like that. And yes.
There's often like three parts to it. When you do such and such, I feel so and so, and then this is what happens. No. I want to leave the room, or it's not pleasant for me to be here, or, you know, something uh-huh. like that. There's a consequence.
Uh huh. Uh huh. So what the situation is, how you feel about it, mm-hmm. and what you feel like doing about it. Mm-hmm. What you're, yeah, okay. Yes.
Just thinking about. I think it was last week or the week before when you were talking about ethics, prescriptive ethics. It seems though prescriptive ethics are you statements, in the sense that you should do this, mm-hmm. you should do that, versus an introspective and a more self-aware statement of yourself and your immediate being is a nice statement.
Yeah. Yeah. And what we're trying to do in our meditation practice itself is to let go of the filter of interpretations of our experience and really recognize what our direct experience is. What are we actually experiencing now? And if we do that in our own meditative practice, then it's very easy to see that making I statements is kind of a way of practicing this practice out loud. You're learning to recognize clearly what your experience is for yourself in meditation. And if you, it's a great place to learn, and then you can maybe learn to recognize it more in everyday life, so you can make kind of the same kind of clear recognitions as you do when you make your noting in your meditation practice. And then what was remarkable in this meeting was that when people make I statements, that it highlights who that person is. That person becomes more clearly who they are. And they stand out more. There's more differences then. How they differentiated from others is clear. But the more real the statements were, the more you could feel that it gave other people a chance to meet them, or to be met, or to offer themselves. And the most dramatic example was at the end of the workshop. She asked, "What's the most difficult or painful thing on the board? What's the biggest conflict between people here?" It took a while to figure that out. And finally, two people sat down in the middle. Two people had something to work out. And they kept kind of wanting to slip off into you statements or abstractions and interpretations. And the role of facilitator was to point that out and say, okay, make an I statement now. And at some point, the woman said a kind of slight abstraction. That would have seemed like a very reasonable and good statement. That in normal conversation, that statement would have been enough for further discussion. But the facilitator interrupted her and said, "How is it for you directly? Make an I statement." And then she thought about it for a while and she said, something like, "In this kind of situation, I don't feel safe, and so I feel like I need to." Protect the situation. I need to protect other people because I don't feel safe for me or for others. And in the end, and that kind of completely loosened up the situation. And what these two people who were in conflict, what they both realized by the time it was over, that both their operating mode was they were very motivated to try to make situations safe for others. They're kind of protectors. And they were trying to protect everybody else, but in the process they had slightly different ways of doing it. And so they clashed and made for a very painful situation. So we can meet, the more we recognize differences, I think the more opportunities we are to meet, or the more we present ourselves as we actually are, the more we're willing to be who we are, the more we give the opportunities for someone else to meet us. And it's too easy to fall into abstractions. There's this great quote from, I think it's David Reynolds, which I have. This is a therapist, I guess actual conversations between a therapist and a client. And the client says, I have no pleasure in life. So that's an abstraction, according to. And then the therapist says, how does that cola taste? And that's something concrete. You know, you're sitting there drinking this cola, and it's probably sweet and nice. I've always had this desire to break through the ordinary, to go beyond. Your shoe is untied. The damn lawyer never gets anything right. I'm always in some mess like this, absolute chaos. Do you notice that you use the words like never or always and absolute a lot? I seem to be confronting all these major issues at once. Did you notice that your car is parked with the headlights still on? I feel anxious all the time. Do you feel anxious now? Yes. Close your eyes, please. What is the color of the rug in the room? What is the color of the drapes? I don't know. Describe clothing. Describe the clothing I'm wearing. I didn't notice. Where is your anxiety right now? Uh-oh, here it comes. Here it comes again. Have I told you the story of Weka and Bodhidharma? Bodhidharma was the person who brought Zen to China, the mythological person. This is all, the story I'm going to tell you is all myth, so you don't get too grossed out. And but it's a teaching story, and Zen is full of wonderful teaching stories. And at some point, Bodhidharma, he comes to China, and one of the first things he does pretty early on is he goes to live for 9 years in a cave. And he lives there in the mountain cave, meditating for 9 years. And the fame of this wonderful Indian meditation master who spreads through China. And a Buddhist monk who's been practicing intensely, studying for a long time, decides to go search out this great Indian meditation master. And he goes there in the middle of the winter, and he goes, stands in front of the cave, and waits for Bodhidharma to kind of receive him. And Bodhidharma will have nothing to do with him. And he stands out there and waits. And it starts snowing. And he stands through the night and through the day, and the snow kind of piles up and piles up. And Bodhidharma still doesn't do anything. And so Weka takes his sword and lops off his arm. And he presents his arm to Bodhidharma to prove his sincerity, that he's really serious, that he isn't just there frivolously. At which point, it gets Bodhidharma's attention. And so Bodhidharma says, well, what do you want? And Weka says, my mind is troubled. Can you help make it, bring it to peace, make it, put it to rest? And Bodhidharma says, show me your troubled mind. And Weka kind of stops for a moment and looks for his mind and then is awakened. And he says, I can't find it. And Bodhidharma says, your mind is at rest. And I don't know, you know, there's many ways maybe interpreting the story, but one of them is that the mind is in part an abstraction, but in part is something which is transparent and translucent. And you can't really point to it. And you can try to point at your mind, but the very attempt to really ask yourself, what is awareness? What is consciousness? It isn't that you don't find nothing. I don't think he found nothing. But he found something which perhaps didn't belong to any categories. Something which didn't belong to the conditioned world. The world of being troubled or not troubled, or suffering or not suffering. And in seeing that unconditioned awareness, he discovered another possibility, another way of living. And then found his rest, found some peace. And the reason, it's kind of a strange story, but kind of what I'm trying to point to is it still has to do with diversity and how we meet diversity and see diversity. In the subject of diversity, one of the words which often comes up is tolerance, learning to develop tolerance for others who are different than you. And I don't like the word tolerance so much myself, because it has kind of a harsh feeling to me. It's something forced. Tolerance, do you have to be? It implies that there has to be a real need to be tolerant. And it's kind of like I talked about patience maybe a few weeks ago. There's maybe two kinds of tolerances. One kind of tolerance is you're intolerant to begin with. And then you try to force yourself to be tolerant, and you remind yourself that, oh, that's a human being also, and they have good qualities, or they're like me, or you do whatever you can to be tolerant of someone else, because basically you're intolerant. And the other way of being tolerant is not to be intolerant to begin with. Intolerance is not even an issue. You simply accept someone as they are without any kind of resistance to who they are. And that's a very different kind of tolerance. It's kind of a tolerance that doesn't really exist. You can't point to that kind of tolerance. The first kind maybe you can point to, the second you can't. Just like you can't maybe point to that kind of mind that Weku was pointed to. So to meet someone else and not to put them in categories or not to put them in some, not, I don't know what category is right. So now I'll make some I statements about how it was for me at this meeting. I was, when we crossed the room, for the most of the time, I didn't fit into any categories that required me to cross the room. And I crossed the room three times, but I felt I didn't really feel like it counted. One of the times was everybody who's a Buddhist, and the whole room went across. So here I was, you know, everybody just went across. It's like nothing had changed. And then one was it was kind of an odd one, I thought, was everyone who had been a child. Well, so everybody crossed again. I didn't quite get what we were doing there, but. And then there was another one was anybody who had been unemployed or homeless, I went across. But I felt that was, when I stood over there, I felt that was kind of a cop-out because I was a 20-year-old hippie. You know, and it was really depressing and very painful not to be able to find work, but it didn't, you know, it didn't last that long, and I didn't really feel like I should be in that category. And I was actually getting a little bit disappointed that finally there were some categories across the room, because I noticed this, you know, I didn't fit in any categories that required me to cross the room. There are some that she could have figured out, but. But anyway, she didn't. And so reflecting a lot on what does it mean to be it wasn't exactly a non-category, but what does it mean to be in that kind of set of people who don't easily go across according to all the reasons of diversity? And I've been noticing this the last 5-6 years, one of the things it means is that at that meeting on Friday, I felt two things. I felt invisible because I didn't have any category, any label that I fit. So I was just standing there in the back of my group, and nothing, you know, I was never pointed out. So I felt a little bit invisible, which wasn't so nice to feel invisible. But the other thing I felt was I felt unobstructed. And that felt actually quite good. And I felt that in some ways the privilege or the advantage that I've had being who kind of person I am in our kind of culture, to more than probably I've realized, my life has been unobstructed. And that kind of unobstruction I take for granted. But it has, you know, I think it has privileges, and it also has maybe some advantages, which I'm here to. And I've been noticing that In the last 5 or 6 years, this privileged category of being a white male Protestant, so-called Protestant by birth at least, has become its own category, which I never thought of the category. The first time I kind of noticed is when I moved to Hawaii for 2 years, and there's a lot of racism there against whites. And there's a first time, one of the first times that I experienced, certainly for 2 years, kind of consistent kind of prejudice from others, because I'd be in situations where I was the only white person, and it was obvious, you know, it's complete aloofness and coldness from other people. And so suddenly, being who I was no longer an unobstructed environment, but who I was an obstruction. It was kind of made the environment difficult to be in. When I was 17, I had long blonde hair, and I spent a summer driving around Italy, and there weren't many long-haired hippies, and every man who passed me on the freeway turned to look. Every man. And then I kind of felt, understanding what it meant, maybe a little bit, what it meant to be a woman in our culture. And then in the last couple of years, in America, here around Stanford, actually, it isn't simply that, like in Hawaii, people just kind of were unfriendly. But I've started to get this antagonism for who I am, from especially certain kind of feminists. You know, a white Protestant male is like, you get the feeling you're like the worst. So I'm beginning to kind of, you know, so the world is not so, we're getting to be so culturally diverse that the class that I happen to be in is no longer so unobstructed. But so what does it mean to be unobstructed? One of the things I was reminded of at this workshop was that the attitude my father had when I was growing up. So I was born in Norway, we're Norwegian, and so we lived most of our life outside of Norway. And my father would say things like, he couldn't ever understand these Norwegians who would be outside of Norway, who would search out other Norwegians to hang out with, because their only bond was that they were fellow Norwegians. And they'd hang out and talk about Norway or Norwegian things. And he couldn't understand that. That seemed silly to him. And you just hang out with your friends, whoever they are. And we had a tremendous diverse amount of friends because I grew up all over. And so I had a very culturally diverse upbringing. But we hardly ever saw any Norwegians because it was just like there was no reason to. We didn't search them out. And I realized at the workshop that that was a slight prejudice that I had. Growing up, I had a slight prejudice against people identifying too strongly with any kind of ethnic grouping because of what my father told me. And I think that so I was glad that became conscious, because that's not really a nice thing to have. However, one of the things that I think anybody who does a religious practice, a spiritual practice, needs to reflect on, or mindfulness practice at least, is we all belong to some kind of, we all have some kind of identity. We all have some kind of difference. We're all unique. How do we hold that uniqueness? How do we hold that identity? What do we do with it? And there's an infinite number of possible ways of holding any kind of identity, any kind of uniqueness. It can be held with tremendous arrogance. It can be held with pride. It can be held with tremendous fear. It can be held with tremendous joy. It can be held many, many different ways. And one of the things that mindfulness clarifies is the way in which we hold all our various identities. Not that we need to get rid of the identities, but that we have to understand the way in which we hold them and what we do with them. Do we use the identities to separate ourselves from others, to create a distance between others? Just that. Do we use it to separate from others, or do we use it to clarify who we are? And I think there's a big difference between the two. And there are some ethnic groups that are very dramatically use their grouping, or whatever kind of grouping, to create separation. And some who don't particularly, just it helps them acknowledge who they are. And then I'd like to end with a... I should have said this at the beginning, but for me, this subject of diversity is something which is mostly a big question mark for me. I should have said at the beginning so that I don't seem like an expert, or I'm just struggling to make sense out of this whole area myself. And it would have been good to have had some discussion to hear from you. And part of the reason I wanted to give this talk was to help me kind of sort through some of the questions and concerns that I have about all this. But I'd like to end with another Zen story. This one probably is closer to true than the first one. And it's a story of Dongshan and Dongshan's enlightenment. And Dongshan was a famous Zen master in China. And he was studying with, maybe he was studying with his teacher. And one of his teachers was Yun Yan. And he said something like this to his teacher. After many years, after far into the future, if someone asks me how I should portray you, how should I respond? And his teacher said, just this person. He probably said, just this person. I don't know. Just this person. And so Dongshan kind of lost himself in thought. He didn't understand the answer. And then his teacher said, having begun the path, you must be very cautious. So then Dongshan left the monastery and went traveling around. And he was thinking about all this conversation. And he came to a bridge over a river. And he looked down into the river and he saw his reflection in the river. And on seeing his reflection, he was enlightened. And then he wrote an enlightenment poem. And this is his poem. Earnestly avoid seeking outside, lest it recede far from yourself. Today I am walking alone, yet everywhere I meet him. He is now no other than myself, but I am not now he. It must be understood in this way in order to merge with suchness. And two lines in this poem appears in another Zen poem, which says, usually translated slightly differently. It's translated, you are it, but it is not you. And one of the things about the world in which we meet, one of the ways of seeing the world, there's a way of understanding it that everything we meet is, in a sense, ourselves. But it is us, but we are not it. There's a wonderful dynamic between differentiation and unification, between uniqueness and similarity, between maybe oneness and difference. One of the heresies in Buddhism is that everything is one. The Buddhists don't like saying that. But the other heresy is that everything is two. Or there's duality. And so Buddhists don't like to say that either. And so there's a third option, which is neither one or two. Or as a Zen poem says, the title of a Zen poem is "Merging of Difference and Unity." The merging of difference and unity. And how do we find this? What is it to meet someone else? What do we do when we meet someone? What happens in that meeting? And if what we're meeting is unique differences between people, and if meetings can really happen best when people are most uniquely themselves, what is that meeting? What happens there? You have to really honor the uniqueness. You have to be unique. You have to kind of expose yourself. You have to be willing to be vulnerable and open. If you're not willing to be vulnerable, you can't be yourself. If you're not willing to be vulnerable, it's very hard to make I statements. I had no idea how you would receive my telling you what it was like to be in a category that was never called out. You know, to explore that with you, to put it out there. You know something about me now that you didn't know before. And I could feel there was some vulnerability in my telling you that. But now you know something about me. You've met me in a different kind of way. I'm more unique than I was for you. I'm more unique probably than I was before. So the merging of difference and unity, not one, not two. The world of awareness, I would like to propose, is the world of oneness. In the field of awareness, everything occurs inside this huge bubble of our awareness. Nothing occurs in our experience outside of this bubble of awareness. Awareness contains it all. This wonderful, transparent, unobstructed field of awareness. Everything is the same within the field of awareness, in a sense. Everything is held by this, equally by the field of awareness. That's where the unity is, I think. That's where the universality is. But within the field of awareness, there are the details of it. There are the particulars within the field of awareness. And those particulars, that's where the uniqueness, that's where the diversity is. And part of, I think, the trick of this practice is to be very present for the details, to really see clearly the differences, and at the same time, understand they're all unfolding within this great field, spacious, peaceful field, of a compassionate field of awareness itself. And that's a kind of way of understanding the merging of difference and unity. And the Dutch writer and philosopher Abel Hertzberg tells a story of a rabbi who, upon entering a room in his home, saw his son deep in prayer. In the corner, he writes, stood a cradle with a crying baby. The rabbi asked his son, "Can't you hear the baby? There's a baby crying in this room." The son said, "Father, I am lost in God." And the rabbi said, "One who is lost in God can see the very fly crawling upon the wall." The merging of difference and unity. So to recognize differences. So I hope that was interesting to talk about diversity, and I'm sorry we didn't have discussion, and it would have been nice.